it's readily available. That is a big plus. And there is a lot of good information available. There are a lot of resources now, a lot of good books that people are writing, a lot of good articles on the internet, a lot of videos. There's plenty of educational materials. So you are much more able to educate yourself. And that's what needs to happen. People have to get into the mindset of you're educating yourself. It's just like, I guess someone could have the mindset that, well, I'm going to a university, they're going to educate me. Reverse that mindset. I'm educating myself. I'm getting assistance from the faculty and staff of this university. It's like Dr. Ali says.
We're out of time.
Okay.
But it's a very good point. Did you want to?
Well, I think that it's important. It's not easy to do because people, I think a lot of things require a certain amount of leisure time. It takes leisure time to do research, to sort of dig through things. And I guess my sense is that it's so important to maintain a sense of critical thinking that, you know, I think that that's what those powers are terrified of, people who actually question things. Mm-hmm. And that upsets them when people question things. But I think that's the reason people should continue to question things on whatever level that's possible. But it's not an easy thing to do. It takes time that a lot of people just don't have in their day. So you have to have a certain amount of understanding that people are intelligent, but they may not be informed.
Right. Well, no, I totally agree with you there. We could discuss this more had we more time. Yeah. But as it is, we're going to move to the next program. I want to thank all of you for joining us at this morning for Heart of Mind, Earth. At midnight, and here we go.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we will have an interview with Elizabeth Crowens, conducted last Wednesday at the Mysterious Bookshop, and a slate of movie reviews from Dan Persons. Stay tuned.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Warcraft is, and I take no pleasure in saying this, Warcraft is a god-awful mess wrapped in a load of hooey. I'd actually written a more fecund term than hooey there, but no, hooey, antiquated a word as it is, does sum up the level of consequence of this film quite well. This is especially disappointing since the director, Duncan Jones, has rapidly built a name for himself with such films as Moon and the underappreciated time travel story Source Code, films that took small-scale productions and put big ideas into them. Warcraft inverts the formula, giving Jones a big and admittedly beautiful and impressive palette to work with, but shrinking the ideas down to something that wouldn't be out of place in a sword and sorcery home video release. An uneven, at times incomprehensible, sword and sorcery release at that. A key aspect of this film is something called the Fell. It gets referred to throughout. I sat through 2 hours of this thing, and I'm still not sure what the Fell is. For about half the film, I thought it was some kind of tribe recruited by the film's orc villain to fight his battles against the humans. That I got from a sequence where a wizard uses magic to vaporize some of the orc attackers while leaving others, the good orcs obviously standing, and one of those orcs exclaims, "The Fell!" But that assumption turned out to be wrong. The Fell is some kind of force, apparently, but if it's a conscious entity thirsting for power or just a serious case of bad vibes, I couldn't tell you. And in the end, I didn't care. Jones tries to invert some cliches, giving us orcs with a sense of morality for one, but that just leads to more confusion as he tries to reconcile the deeper emotional beats of these creatures with their use as an implacable invasion force. It can be done, but the director hasn't found the equation here. I like Jones. I respect his intelligence and ingenuity. Those were sadly thwarted by Warcraft. When you can get a more compelling mise-en-scene from any episode of Adventure Time, then your epic fantasy is in big trouble. And unfortunately, there are a couple of films that I missed the release dates of, but I do want to make note of them because they are worth your attention. Hopefully they'll come around again on home video or elsewhere. The Fitz is an unusual coming-of-age film about a young girl who seeks admission into her school's dance team, just as the older girls begin to be stricken one by one by a wave of unexplained seizures. Director Anna Rose Homer manages to mix a documentary-like reality the film is set and was shot in Cincinnati with a unique metaphor for a child who stands at the threshold of adulthood and looks toward the future with both fear and longing. It's a fascinating and heartfelt film. Reality and fantasy clash as well in Mad Tiger, a documentary about the comedic rock band P. Lander Z, a kind of cross-cultural mashup of punk music and Japanese Sentai superhero TV shows. The film is less a career review and more a record of the band and its founders Kengo Hayoki and Kotaro Kusada as they confront a significant and possibly devastating crossroad in their future, as members decide to step away from their lives of impersonating benevolent musical aliens. Directors Michael Hartline and Jonathan Yee manage to capture the surprisingly serious consequences behind the actions of a bunch of guys who spend their evenings cavorting on stage in tacky, color-coded superhero get-ups. Turns out, even unabashed silliness can extract a high emotional toll. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote, and let's defeat Trump.
And once again, good morning. By way of disclosure, I should mention that for me, it's actually afternoon. I'm pre-recording this material the afternoon before broadcast. Our main feature this morning is an interview conducted with Elizabeth Crowens last week at the Mysterious Bookshop in Tribeca, downtown Manhattan, on the occasion of the debut of her first novel, Silent Meridian, which features one of the characters in the book as Arthur Conan Doyle, and, in a manner of speaking, in the person of Teal James Glenn, Sir Arthur joined us. So now you set your way back machine and join us as well.
Thank you all very much for coming to the Mysterious Bookshop tonight. For those of you who don't know us, we've been in business for 37 years. We are the oldest mystery bookshop in the country. We are located here at 58 Warren Street, and you can also find us online at mysteriousbookshop.com. Tonight, we are here to celebrate the release of Silent Meridian, which is Elizabeth Crowan's first novel. And it features the iconic Sir Arthur Conan Doyle on a cross-worlds adventure. It's pretty exciting, and I think you guys will be delighted with it. We're also joined tonight by Jim Freund, who is the producer of Hour of the Wolf on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Okay, now let me explain something. This is in the form of a radio program, and this is a radio program. We are, in fact, recording and filming and all that good stuff. But basically, I do a weekly program that's been on the air since, God help me, 1972, and called Hour of the Wolf. It's primarily about science fiction, but this falls into that. But I will say that I've also covered the Edgar Awards and stuff, so there's lots of mystery crossover. And so what this actually is, as the way Elizabeth initially proposed it, is this is an episode of my program. Okay, so I am your host, and I will begin, and I will do introductions and things like that. I will then introduce the mysterious Sir Arthur, and after we'll start with a short interview, then the reading, then a longer interview, some Q&A, and an epilogue. But I will ask you to treat this as if it were a broadcast studio. Yes, I can edit. I'd rather not have to. And all that means is, number one, please put your phones to vibrate. And if you ask a question, if you talk, this is facing this way. It will not hear you. So even if the question is for Sir Arthur or an actor, if there should be one in the house, or for Elizabeth, please address it in a manner that either Elizabeth or I can then reiterate your question so it will end up on the air. So I think that's basically it. And having said that, you're rolling. At any rate, hello, welcome. This is, so I'm going to do it as if it were a radio show. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. It is 6:44 on a all of a sudden glorious day outside. And today's date is the 8th of June of the year 16. And we are, as Ian mentioned, in the Mysterious Bookshop. And which isn't all that mysterious. It's a wonderful bookshop. But yeah, what's mysterious is you come in, and when you leave, you spent all your money. That may not be all that mysterious in and of itself. But to introduce things properly, this is Elizabeth Crowan's debut novel. Elizabeth Crowan's is the pen name, of the author and the author of Silent Meridian, book one in the Time Traveler Professor series, and which is an alternate history, spooky steampunk novel. She's published a variety of nonfiction articles and recently won an honorable mention in Glimmer Train's Fiction Short Story Contest for emerging writers. A 15-year veteran of the film industry in Hollywood, Elizabeth Crowan is also an alumnus of Algonquian. I disputed that. I thought it was Algonquin. I was proved wrong by howdjousay.com. And Algonquian Workshops and the Gotham Writers Workshop, a member of the Horror Writers Association. An active Sherlockian, she has lectured on Arthur Conan Doyle, belongs to several Sherlockian groups, and is an independent scholar on Eastern and Western mysticism and Jungian psychology, a black belt in martial arts, so I'm going to be nice. She's lived in Japan and currently in New York City. So everybody, please welcome Elizabeth Sands. So I guess the very first question is how this came about.
How it came about. I collect antiques. And I actually came across, in my antique collecting days, some diaries of somebody who claimed he was a ghostwriter of Arthur Conan Doyle. And that's what...
Probably actually meant ghostwriter, but...
Yes, exactly.
Well, he wasn't into ghosts. He was into fairies, I believe.
Yes. Yep. No. He was like an original Victorian Ghostbuster.
He
was very much into ghost sighting and trying to prove that there was life after death.
Yeah.
So he was very much into this, and it started around the 1880s, and it became obsessive with him around the time of World War I, because he lost his son, his brother, and brother-in-law.
Yeah.
To the Great War. And there were a lot of people, including some very famous scientists, that were very obsessive about having seances and trying to contact the spirits of their dead, you know, their loved ones.
It was the era.
Yeah, absolutely.
Victorian and Edwardian.
Yeah.
They loved that stuff.
Sure.
And, and that leads to, because this is not simply about Sir Arthur, this is the time traveler. Professors.
Correct. And as I said...
Which, by the way, means we're going to be doing this again. This is merely book one.
Yes. There are going to be about 7 books in the entire series.
Yay.
Yes. So be ready for a long ride, but an interesting one. I'm an antiquarian book collector, so you could obviously tell I love going into a place like this. And I actually came across... some interesting diaries years ago of somebody who claimed he had this relationship that nobody ever heard of. And it just spurred me on to start writing these fiction stories, because I fictionalized everything because there was no proof of anything. And I figured this is a very good story going on. So that's how I started everything.
Mm-hmm. And it's a rollicking story, I may say. It's got a wonderful... Well, people will find out very shortly. Before we go into the reading, would you like to give us a bit of a précis of what the first book is, what Silent Meridian is about? And it's, overall, it's called the Time Traveler Professor series, right?
Yes, correct. Okay. The protagonist is a gentleman named John Patrick Scott. And in book one, it starts out he's in his last year of college, and he's a music student. He's aspiring to be a concert pianist and also a music theorist. And lots of strange things happen to this guy, and he can't figure out why. Lots of strange paranormal events. He feels he has a ghost that follows him around. He has very strange dreams. He feels like he's in different times, in different places. And he's also incredibly fascinated with H.G. Wells's The Time Machine, which had been released a few years before. And that's his favorite book. So he takes it upon himself to build his own contraption and experiment with it. And more very strange things start happening to him. And therefore, he just feels that... it's going to take somebody about as smart as Sherlock Holmes to figure out what on earth is happening. So he tracks down Doyle. And Doyle was actually running for a political office at the time. So Doyle is originally from Edinburgh, which is where our protagonist is going to his last year at the University of Edinburgh. And he is making a trip to Edinburgh at the time, which actually coincided in reality. So I kind of timed everything with the timing of the book. But he really wants an explanation as to what might be happening. And we'll be starting out our first chapter with the first time meeting of the two of them. And something very interesting happens that he does not expect.
Okay, well, let's bring on your co-reader in that case. And let me introduce him for those who haven't seen him on TV or in, I think there's some movies, and there's, this is not Robert Downey, this is not Benedict Cumberbatch, this is Sir Arthur Ignatius Conan Doyle, who was a British writer and physician most noted for creating the fictional detective Sherlock Holmes and writing stories about him, that's a Lestrade accent there, and writing stories about him which are generally considered milestones in the field of crime fiction. An ophthalmologist, I believe, yeah. And which is where the doctor comes from, and he was knighted, he was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, he took his middle name and made that part of his surname at some point, because he wrote a tract about the Boer War.
Yes.
That's what he was knighted for. It had nothing to do with his fiction writing. It was his nonfiction writing, which I find
fascinating. Actually, he served in the military. So he went down to the Boer War, and he was working as a medical doctor.
As a medical doctor, yes. Because he could not serve. He was what they, in Edwardian England they called 4F. So, but he served in other ways. So, I hope people get the sarcasm in the 4F thing. Regardless of that, everybody, please welcome Sir Arthur.
So we're going to start out with the first chapter of the book. And it starts out in Edinburgh in 1898. You're checking your watch. Scotland was just barely crawling its way out of the 19th century. I was a naive but ambitious student studying music at the University of Edinburgh, hurrying over to meet Arthur Conan Doyle, the man who would change my life forever. "John Patrick Scott," I said, as I approached Mr. Doyle, who was already seated at a back corner where he hoped he wouldn't be recognized. He had picked the Deacon Brodie, the pub that inspired the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I extended my hand to greet him and removed my rain-soaked hat, while my overcoat slipped out of my hands and fell on the floor by accident. It was still hard to believe that good fortune finally brought us together, but we were both nervous.
The pleasure is all mine.
Mr. Conan Doyle, or should I call you Dr. Doyle? I said, unsure how to address him. Doyle scrutinized me from top to bottom as he signaled for the waiter.
John, call me Arthur.
Sir, I'm so honored you agreed to discuss this matter. Perhaps you can enlighten me in a way that I've failed to comprehend. I wanted to ask him about my unusual turn of events straight away, but he caught me off guard and was dead set on pulling me into the swift current of unexpected conversation.
Can I assume you believe in the transmigration of souls?
Until now, I haven't given it a lot of thought, I said, unsure of which direction he was leading.
Did you ever read those books about the Swiss doctor who felt his body and soul had been taken over by a Benedictine monk? That presented a curious case. He claims that he was approached by the spirit of an elderly monk before he died, and that the monk needed to rent his body to continue his spiritual mission.
Rent? I choked in disbelief.
We truly don't take anything with us when we pass on, do we? This monk knew that he was dying and therefore had to replace his physical body with something more youthful and vital.
That's incredible. It debunks the theory that you have to die and be reborn as an infant to carry on your spirit.
John, here's another instance. I've had my suspicion about a famous musician who had an obsession with a notorious and controversial mystic. You'd surmise by his overwhelming attraction to that person that he might have been him in a previous lifetime, but facts were clear that he was born 3 years before that mystic died. My understanding is that the mystic knew he didn't have long in his present incarnation. Therefore, he made plans for some sort of partial soul transference while he was still alive to imprint his essence upon the child. That would have allowed him to carry on his accomplishment unfinished business that couldn't have been executed otherwise. Essentially, he had the ability of being two places at once.
Sounds more like spiritualism.
Honestly, John, I don't think there's any steadfast rules when it comes to this matter. That's what makes it so intriguing.
I sensed he had a secret agenda. Doyle reloaded his churchwarden pipe with fresh tobacco and continued.
This is not all like anything you've ever read from H.G. Wells or Jules Verne. We're poking holes in every treatise written on the subject. The idea of being able to reincarnate a part of yourself while you're still alive into another soul. Fiction it may seem, but to me it's not hocus pocus. Don't you also find it strange that you somehow found yourself initiated into a mystical order on a commuter train bound from London to Edinburgh when the instigators kept on mistaking you for me? There are no accidents.
I became silent for a moment, stalling for time as I slowly raised my glass of ale to my lips. As soon as I fished a small red book out of my coat pocket, placed it on the table in front of Arthur. He eyed it intently. It had been the source of intrigue that led me to Doyle in the first place, and had piqued his curiosity as much as it did mine. Could I have done something terrible in my youth that caused this to happen?
You have no recollections, John?
I remember so little of my childhood. I wish I could.
You're a smart young man. I'm sure you'll come up with a clever deduction.
Mr. Doyle paused to relight his pipe. He had an unnerving look in his eye, which I vainly tried to read into. But he took me for a spin when he brought up the next topic.
On another note, John, have you ever considered that people have the capability of communicating without speech? And I'm not talking about writing letters.
Pardon me?
Imagine communicating by mere thought. I've always wanted to experiment with someone open to these concepts. God knows, my brothers in the Society of Psychical Research certainly talk enough about it. My wife, Tui, has been an unwilling subject and is not the most objective choice.
Are you asking me to accurately guess what you're thinking?
Come now, we'll play a game. I'll form an image in my mind, and the next minute I will try to project it into yours. Clear your thoughts and any distractions and be as receptive as possible.
As much as I tried, I couldn't have been more preoccupied. Images of that fateful event flashed through my brain. Once again, my recollections revealed my rain-soaked ticket in hand. I kept on arguing with the steward that I thought he was putting me in the wrong train cabin. An erroneous judgment had been made with three strangers who insisted I was Arthur. He and I couldn't have been more in physical appearance. He was a large, athletic man with a distinguished mustache. On the other hand, I had baby smooth skin and couldn't grow facial hair to save my life. I was nearly 20 years younger and much shorter, with wild auburn hair that resembled Maestro Beethoven's, with the exception of premature strands of gray. It was impossible that I could have been mistaken for him, so why was I singled out? Was there laudanum in my brandy? Details spun like a whirlwind. I must have been in a drug-induced stupor, but I was initiated into some secret Masonic-like society. And when it was all over, these mysterious men were gone. What remained was an engraved silver ring on my finger and an ominous red book on the seat beside me.
Looks like you've seen a ghost.
Arthur realized my thoughts had been elsewhere. I felt like I had, I said, barely able to articulate. I tried to tame my wild mane in place. Visions faded in and out. Timelines jumped, so I gulped down another swig of ale to focus on the present.
I can see you're still worried about the event on the train. Those men have been after me for some time. Why? It's hard to fathom. I'll dilly-dally with notions here and there about Sherlock Holmes and his partner Watson, who fancy themselves as detectives. Me? I'm just a simple country doctor, writer with an interest in spiritualism, trying to find scientific explanations for the unknown.
Arthur, what would anyone want with an unassuming music student like me?
Personally, I don't think this is a case of identity.
Obviously, he meant to say that my dilemma was not a case of mistaken identity, not the name of one of his famous Sherlock stories. He was pleased that I caught the humor of his play on words.
Perhaps it has something to do with that book.
I'm concerned that it's dangerous, that it's a curse. I wish I had never found it. I replied as I shoved it back into my pocket and drained my glass. One week later, as I was returning home from school, my landlady, Lydia Campbell, yelled from the kitchen as I trudged my muddied shoes through the front door of her boarding house. John, a letter from Undershaw arrived for you today. I wonder who it could be from. You don't know anyone from Undershaw, do you? Oh, yes, I did. I snatched the letter and ran upstairs so fast that I nearly tripped on my muffler and fell on my face. I poured myself a glass of port to calm my nerves, doffed my wet garments, and sat into my most comfortable brass-studded leather chair that I affectionately called my thinking chair, where I created many a melody in my head and could think deep thoughts and drift off to dreamland. And this is what the letter said.
Dear John, I wholeheartedly enjoyed our conversation at the Deacon Brodie and kept my promise of a prompt reply. By now, you're well aware of the fact that my passion to explore the realms of spiritualism and related paranormal phenomena far surpasses any personal interest involved with Sherlock Holmes. A public demand for my writing, however, exerts a strain on how much I can overtly reveal to even the most trusted colleagues. Whenever I indulge in any activity, be it a simple seance, investigating a revered medium, or attending a meeting of the British Society of Psychical Research, it never fails to raise the eyebrows of my wary publishers and critics. I truly believe in many of the inexplicable accounts. Even my father painted beautiful renditions of fairies, which I trust that he witnessed with his own eyes. The betterment of mankind rests on embracing such theories once they are proven to exist by the scientific community. Thus, I suspect I'll have to continue more controversial and debatable endeavors in utmost secrecy, or at least for the time being, until more evidence can be brought to light. Since you seem an open-minded young man who has already experienced some effects of the preternatural, this is my proposal. At midnight, every night, we should conduct a variety of remote operations with the primary purpose of communicating through means of telepathy. Since I have a tendency to travel, we'll have to make some sort of an adjustment to take into account the different time zones. Of course, you must share this secret with nobody. Besides us, only my wife will know, although she will not participate. When you shared the account of the strange incident on board the commuter train, that was enough to convince me that you would be the perfect partner for this private undertaking. Most assuredly, there was something you had done in the past in the realm of the arcane to warrant that chain of events. That was not mere happenstance. And now, since you possess that enigmatic red book, I'm sure it will affect your life in ways you have never imagined. My intentions have been to also perform similar trial and error enterprises with Harry Houdini, a rising star whose stage performances have been astounding audiences, but his busy schedule had made it near impossible so far to coordinate such engagements with any sort of regularity. One of these days we'll catch up. Meanwhile, I'll collect whatever news comes from across the herring pond. I suspect that at one point he and I will develop a special relationship based on our mutual interests. Regarding the two of us, however, we'll back up our observations with letters or telegrams as often as possible as proof of results. But those must be destroyed as soon as they are read. Once again, I cannot overemphasize the importance of confidentiality. Whenever we know that we will be otherwise engaged, we should attempt to communicate with each other in spirit to appraise the other of that fact. Regardless, we must keep a faithful agreement, as skill will come with practice. If you're willing to put aside any apprehensions regarding trains, I'll pay for you to travel down to Undershaw and visit me on weekends whenever possible. My driver can meet you in London at a prearranged time. You'll stay in one of our guest bedrooms, and as long as you don't mind the children and can tolerate what our kitchen staff provides, you'll be well taken care of. That'll give us the opportunity to explore our repertoire and commence further psychical experimentation with ectoplasm, spirit photography, and astral projection. And bring that book. I'd like a chance to examine it. I've also desired a partner to accompany me on ghost sightings and occult investigations. For all we know, with the knowledge gained, we might even break through the barriers of time. That would certainly give Bertie, H.G. Wells, a shock to the senses, proving that his imagination does not merely dwell in the realm of fiction. He and I have been at odds on that subject for years. Regarding telepathic technique, I can only suggest that you conduct yourself as you see fit. Personally, I don't believe in things like magical amulets, but if it helps to have an etheric link to me, use this letter you hold in your hand, as it contains my heart, my soul, and signature with a drop of blood, which I added to the ink. You might wish to reciprocate. Let's raise our glasses to honor the quest of conquering the unknown. Sincerely, Arthur Conan Doyle.
Well, Arthur was apparently serious when he first brought up the subject. When he and I left the pub, I really didn't know what to think. After all, he was a famous author, and I was merely a student. What possessed him to choose me for such an engagement? I shuffled through my schoolwork to find my pen and ink and a fresh sheet of paper. Blood. I needed blood. Ah, my razor. That would work. I fetched my shaving kit and winced as I drew a few drops of blood. I scribbled a swift, affirmative reply with the blood-tainted ink, mailed the letter the next day, and looked forward to our first otherworldly encounter. Now we're going to skip ahead a few chapters, and thank you. And Arthur and John have now been doing these psychical experiments for a little while. So the title of this chapter is called A Lesson in Magic. Arthur, this is ludicrous. It's not working, I said as I began to get a stiff neck from concentrating too hard. I rushed over to my piano, slammed my fingers down on the keyboard, playing several loud, discordant, frustrating sounds of nonsense, downed a shot of brandy, and plunged back into my chair, loosening my tie. Thank God the entire boarding house was empty. My landlady took the train to London to attend a play that her niece Florence was starring in. She began the entire weekend, which afforded me the luxury of peace and quiet without the possibility of interruption.
John, for some the ability to move objects with the mind comes right away. For others, it could take hundreds of attempts before experiencing any perceivable results.
That's encouraging, I said. With a hint of sarcasm, I'm beginning to think this is all rubbish. Our trial-and-error attempts at telekinesis were stretching the limits of my imagination. First of all, Arthur and I were not in the same room when they took place. We were communicating telepathically and agreed to try these tests while I remained in Edinburgh, and he was wherever he would be at that weekend. By sheer persistence, we established a telepathic link so strong that we might as well have been using Morse code or speaking over a telephone line with little distinction. We had started this correspondence when we first met and continued no matter where we'd be at any given time, and Arthur was quite a man for travel. We might have made some progress communicating, but there was a long way to go in regards to moving solid objects with self-generated psychic energy. In front of me, I had a crystal paperweight and a candle and a brazier full of church incense and a photo of Arthur and my journal open to a blank page so I could take notes documenting our progress. Our first test involved pulling the flame, which meant we tried to manipulate each other's candles from afar. By projecting psychic energy, we'd make the candles flicker and change shapes. But that seemed too difficult to prove whether the results were successful or not. My aim was to move on to denser, heavier objects that I had selected on the table, but I was losing my patience. So far, those attempts have been futile.
If you really take telekinesis down to its lowest common denominator, all movement, whether it is turning on the engine of a motor car and traveling out to the countryside or overcoming your inertia to get out of your chair and walk across the room, is telekinesis, as you have utilized thought to complete and accomplish both actions. If everything boils down to energy, that we are made of energy like the paperweight on your table, if the hay I feed my horse gives him energy to move their muscles and pull my cart, that steam can turn all the mechanisms to make a locomotive move down the track at remarkable speeds, that lighting a candle will not only provide light but also warmth, then there has to be something said that when we meditate, we can create a tingling in our fingers and have our entire hand feel warm. There's a science behind this.
I drank the last drop of brandy from my glass and then closed my eyes. My clairvoyant sight honed in on Arthur as I could visualize him in his favorite chair lighting his pipe. Perhaps we'll have more success after I've had a good night's sleep. Sorry to be such a disappointment, I said, somewhat embarrassed.
John, life is infinitely stranger than anything which the mind of man could invent. We would not dare to conceive the things which are really mere commonplace of existence.
He couldn't have requoted a better line from Sherlock Holmes. He rose, walked over to his study window, and continued quoting from his stories.
If we could fly out that window hand in hand, hover over the city, gently removing the roofs, to peep in at the queer things that were going on, the strange coincidences, the planning, the cross purposes, the wonderful chains of events working through generations and leading to the most outre results, it would make all fiction with its conventionalities and foreseen conclusions most stale and unprofitable.
Besides a good memory of some of your famous lines from A Case of Identity, what are you insinuating, Arthur?
That one's imagination creates one's own game, John. Was there something you wanted to explore with our preternatural undertakings this evening?
I paused a second. This must sound absurd, but I'd love to play a trick on Professor Lorraine Smith from the medical school. Close to a year ago, I was walking across campus, and I fell right into his path after stumbling upon wet cobblestones and was quite surprised that he kept on walking as if I were invisible, despite the fact that I was covered with mud from head to toe. In fact, since he was a doctor, I was surprised he didn't stop and ask whether or not I had been hurt. For months afterwards, when I passed him every day going to classes, I was embarrassed to make eye contact with him, wondering if he still remembered if I was that clumsy music student who nearly knocked him down. As a testimony to our telekinetic exercises really working, I'd love to have the ability to make the professor drop his briefcase or umbrella, forcing him to pick it up and realize I had something to do with it. That would be significant proof of my ability to impose mind over matter.
You'd like to play a trick on him?
That would be more significant than making my paperweight fall off the table. Besides, no harm will be done. Isn't it true that all those medical professors are two bricks short of a load? I've heard rumors that they'd experiment on themselves by injecting viruses, thereby exposing themselves to all sorts of ailments. Didn't you tell me that Dr. Bell, the man who was your mentor and inspiration for Sherlock Holmes, was notorious for research like that?
Very well. We will use Dr. Lorraine Smith as our test subject. Oh, John, one last thing.
What's that?
I've been so proud that you've been so dedicated and faithful to these attempts. I'm going to leave you with a token of my appreciation.
Arthur's ghostly astral body extended its hand and reached towards mine with a hearty handshake. Thinking nothing of it at first, as his apparition began to fade and disappear from my room, I winced in disgust at the sticky, honey-like residue coating my hand and wrist and extending to drench the cuff of my starched and pressed dress shirt. Damn it, he loves his ectoplasm! It was repulsive and disgusting, and I was covered with slime.
We will return to Sir Arthur for an epilogue in a little while, but I thought it would be proper to give credit where it's due and unmask, well, he's not wearing a mask, but unpipe Teal James Glenn, who's been a stuntman, a fight choreographer, sword master, jouster, between the two of them, the black belt, jouster, illustrator, storyteller, bodyguard, actor, and haunted house barker. So you go into a haunted house and you hear barking. As a writer, he has had stories in Weird Tales, Spine Tingler, Mad, Black Belt, Fantasy Tales, Pulp Empire, Sherlock Holmes Mystery, Six Gun Western, Silver Blade Quarterly, and scores of others, and 36 books. TJ, which is, as he is better known, which I didn't know, because she told me TJ was going to read, and I said, oh, I don't know who that is, and it's like, oh, it's Teal. I know him. TJ was the winner of the 2012 Polk Arc Award for Best Author, and his website may be found at the Urban Swashbuckler. com. So TJ and Sir Arthur will be back in just a few minutes, but...
This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. You are listening to an interview that was conducted last Wednesday at the Mysterious Bookshop with Elizabeth Crowens. And now we continue.
Let me just remind people this is, in essence, the taping of a radio program. By the way, I have flyers for the program all the way at the front by the mailing list. And we are in the Mysterious Bookshop, which is a place to behold. So when in New York, assuming that you might be just a listener, do pay a visit. So we are discussing Silent Meridian, the launch of a series of, to begin with, 7 novels by nobody named Crowley, by Elizabeth Crowens. And what research did you do? Yeah, for those not watching their radios, her eyes just went up to the heavens with that question.
Yes, at least 3 trips across the pond, buying a lot of antiquarian books and an obsession about details of the time period, which started in 1898, and the book, actually, the timeline of the first book ends at the outbreak of the First World War. So I've actually done quite a bit of significant research of the First World War and afterwards already, and a lot of the second book has been written because of that. So, but yes, I had to spend quite a bit of time in the UK, in Scotland, and also in Germany. Because if you when you read the book, you will see that our protagonist actually goes to Germany for a few years before the war.
Okay, so, Both, okay, so both sides of that, of the channel as well as the pond.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where in England, in Edinburgh and all that, were you going to any specific libraries, any specific houses?
A lot of libraries, sure. Well, the protagonist is based on a real person, and I've obviously changed all names. Right. But he actually did attend the University of Edinburgh. So, of course, I had to spend some time over there. And a lot of time in Edinburgh as well. But because many times I would be walking up and down streets where my protagonist was walking. So, of course, you have to be able to describe everything. But also, he did spend some time in London, and, of course, so did Conan Doyle. So I wanted to spend a significant amount of time in London. And at one point, the protagonist gets a scholarship to a music school in Stuttgart, Germany. So I had to, of course, go to Stuttgart. And and I went to about seven other cities in Germany, as well as Prague and Vienna. So these were a lot of cities that I knew that the protagonist had gone to, and I did a lot of research, including going into libraries where I was looking for images of what these places looked like prior to World War I, mm-hmm. actually. And a lot of these places had been destroyed, obviously.
Yeah.
So I would go, and I literally gave myself about 3.5 weeks to crash course in German to be able to go into these libraries and do the research.
You said the primary characters are all based on real. Are there any, and I'm asking also ahead to the, through the future series.
Yes.
Are there characters of fiction?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you tell us anything about them, or are there too many reveals if we...
I think, read the book.
Okay. Fair enough.
On that one.
How much study of things medical and... for that matter, here's a better one. The supernatural,
yes.
And all that plays a very important part, a very important role in all this. How did you research that? What were your sources?
What were my sources? I've been studying that for over 30 years. So a lot of sources.
Okay.
Yes.
And in your bio, this may be a debut novel as Elizabeth Crowan, but you were 15 years in Hollywood,
yes.
And all that. What were you doing there, if I may ask?
A lot of different things. Primarily a still photographer, but I also worked as a script supervisor. I worked basically from soup to nuts, from development through distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked with a lot of film publicists and distribution companies. I also, believe it or not, read scripts for a producer and did script analysis and write-ups. And we were actually one of the few production companies that allowed unagented submissions.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually was the slush pile reader, basically, over for a producer who is unfortunately no longer with us. But I did a lot of different things. But I would say I've probably been on about 50 independent features, maybe about 25 television shows.
Wow.
Yeah.
What is your nonfiction about?
My nonfiction, again, soup to nuts, but believe it or not, I have written a lot of martial arts articles.
Really?
So in the October-November 2013 issue of Black Belt Magazine, I actually wrote an article called Bartitsu, The Real Martial Arts of Sherlock Holmes. So apparently, if anybody is familiar with The Adventure of the Empty House, when he describes as to how he managed not to fall into the Reichenbach Falls with Wrestling Moriarty, he used a martial arts technique called Baritsu, which was actually spelled wrong. It was Bartitsu. And there was a dojo in London founded by a guy named Barton Wright. And it was a mixed martial arts. He basically got two jiu-jitsu guys from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
He also brought Lacan experts, stick fighting experts, and French savate, foot kicking technique, which was a sailor's technique, and good old-fashioned bare-knuckle pugilism.
Wow.
So it was a combination. And what was so fascinating about this dojo was that they were teaching the suffragettes how to protect themselves from the police because they were getting beaten up by the police. So they had female martial arts classes for the suffragettes so they would not get beaten up by the police.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And they used to call it suffragitsu.
Oh.
And that's true.
Doyle was, he believed in the suffragette movement, I believe.
That I don't recall reading anything in particular that he's written about.
Okay, yeah, because yeah. He stood for office a couple of times.
Yeah.
What was the party it was? I was reading it on the way here, and I'd forgotten, but it was unusual. And I always have my stupid, stupid question, which is, why is it in England they stand for office, but in the U.S. they run for office?
Oh, God, no.
But nobody I've asked...
Runs. Hmm?
Yeah, that may very well have been it. In England, you couldn't stand still. You could stand, so you could stand for election. Yes, Daniel.
I'll try to project or repeat the question. Can you and Jim demonstrate some barjitsu for us?
Oh, God, no.
I can be the dummy.
Yeah.
That would work. And anybody, if you're listening on the radio, it's like, oh. Anyway.
Right. Actually, TJ is a sword master, and he would probably be the perfect person, but I would be lousy against his.
Yeah, I'm closer to being a sore master. It's a whole
sore master, yes.
Kind of a thing. Why don't we open up to questions? And what we're going to do again is, bearing in mind this is like a radio show, allow us to repeat your question so that those at home may hear you. So,
my name's Randy.
Yes.
What kicked off your interest in Sherlock Holmes, and when did this happen?
What kicked off your interest in Sherlock Holmes, and when did this happen? I'm channeling.
Right. Well, I always liked Sherlock Holmes, and in fact, I'm kind of a latecomer to the scene because. There were some of the Sherlock, like movie and television venues that I've really only been exposed to in the last few years. So, and I started doing it as a result of the research for the novel. As I said, I fell into this because I'm an antiquarian book collector. And I came across some very interesting things. So I said, well, God, this guy says he aligned with Doyle. I guess I better start reading more of his stuff. So I've read quite a few, and I've actually collected quite a lot of Doyle's other historical novels, as well as
he wrote a lot of science fiction.
Well, yeah, that, and he also did a lot of documentary history as well. So I was picking up a lot of his books and reading and seeing where he was at, and of course, probably read at least 15 biographies or autobiographies of him as well. So I just became obsessed about this because I started reading the book. I actually started this book, the first draft, a little embarrassed to say this, over 33 years ago. It was done on an electric typewriter before anybody had a home computer. And it was dreadful. It was absolutely horrible. And I put it on the shelf for years. So I resurrected the project about 5 years ago, and that's when I started doing the trips to Europe and said, if I'm writing about Germany, I better go to Germany. If I'm writing about Edinburgh, I better go over there.
Yep, sounded pretty good to me. Hello.
Hi, my name is Vicki Oliver. Tell us about the cover of the book. What inspired the icons that you're using on the cover? How did the cover come to you?
So Vicki is asking us about the cover of the book and the icons and how the cover came to be. And also, I'll ask a question, which will not be the first time these words were heard at the mysterious bookshop, Whodunit.
Whodunit, right, exactly. It was a collaborative effort between Brian Berlanger, who is a freelancer who works for MX Publishing, who is my publisher out of London, and myself. I actually had originally came up with some of the original images because I'm also pitching this as a film series, and that's my background. So a lot of times I actually, because I was a still photographer for so many years in Hollywood, I used to art direct a lot of movie posters. So I mocked up basically a movie poster as a lead behind. So if I actually was in Los Angeles at the time pitching to some producers, this is what I would leave behind so they have a visual image as to how everything would be. And one of the photos in the background is actually an arch and a gas lamp from the University of Edinburgh Medical School. And I actually took the photo. And I had a very nice gentleman who was the professor of the music department over there give me a little tour of the campus. So I took some pictures over there. And that, of course, is where Arthur Conan Doyle went to medical school. So that had some significance. And that's my photo in the background. And from the research that I came up with, the John Patrick Scott, Brian came up with some stock photos, but it was very close to what the original guy looked like at that age. And I had originally mocked up with a casting hopeful, which of course we did not have the copyright on. Mm-hmm. So we needed to use stock photography on that. And he found a much better photo of Doyle than I did. So that's kind of how it evolved.
I would have assumed a lot of those photos are public domain.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So that's how we came up with the cover.
Hi, my name is Kathy, and I'm wondering, I picked up a book in London about Conan Doyle's work with criminals.
Hmm.
And did you come across much of that?
So the question again. You can reiterate it. Or,
sure.
Conan Doyle did work with criminals.
Oh, yeah.
He exonerated two people that were convicted of crimes.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact.
One person, I always pronounce his name, Ajali, he was from, I think, originally from Zanzibar. And Conan Doyle was very active in getting him off the hook for an accusation of I think somebody was mutilating horses, and there were quite a few of them. But he totally did a whole Sherlock Holmes number as far as that's concerned, because the guy had very poor eyesight, and he kind of went to the scene of the crime and pointed out a lot of issues that somebody with eyesight, he was legally blind essentially, and somebody with such poor eyesight could have not possibly done these particular crimes, and he literally saved the guy's life. And unfortunately, at the time of the trial, there was obviously, because he was, I think he might have been half Indian, there was obviously incredible racism. So the fact that he was not a white male, you know, was not going to be in his favor as far as the courtroom situation was concerned. And when Doyle got married the second time, he actually invited Ajali, and you're going to have to really bear with me because I probably am pronouncing his name wrong, to his wedding, which was really an accomplishment. It was really wonderful. In fact, I even mentioned it in the book. Yeah, and there was also an Oscar Slater case that he worked on, and that was a murder case where an elderly woman was found dead and jewelry stolen. And he managed to get Oscar Slater off. I think one of the cases, though, that he did not manage, there was Kasich. It was an Irish person when there were a lot of, you know, the uprisings and everything in Ireland. And that Roger Kasich, I think it was. But that one, he unfortunately was not successful. I think the guy was executed.
How did he get involved in these cases to begin with? Was he invited?
I think he was interested. And because he was such a celebrity, you know, it's like, oh, wow. You know, the writer of Sherlock Holmes wants to really solve a real murder case. Yeah, sure. Bring him in. You know, so I think he got lucky because of his celebrity and that he wanted to do it. So I know he kind of felt like a sense of injustice was being served as far as George Ajali was concerned. And same thing with Oscar Slater. So, yeah, now he stepped up to the plate a few times.
Yeah. Any more questions? Because if there aren't, I'm going to have a bad pun. Okay. She knows my puns, so she knew to avoid that trap.
They'll save for a few moments. The women that participated in the suffragette suit, do you know what uniforms, if they wore uniforms, or were they wearing their everyday was to learn how to do self-defense?
The question is about uniforms in the suffragette suit.
I can't answer that question. I know that Edith Garaud, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct, it's like G-A-R-A-U-D, was the head of the movement in England. But we actually have a suffragette expert in the audience, and she's like probably going to be cowering. but she's dealing more with the American movement. She,
dealing more with the American movement, and, you know, I haven't stumbled on that interesting fact yet. So.
Every photo I've seen, they have been wearing gay clothes.
I know.
Okay. Okay.
You know what I mean? Just like they wore gay clothes to play tennis, too. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't want to find a joy.
Right. I'm referring, of course, she's not being recorded, but Vicki Oliver is writing a wonderful novel about the American movement.
Oh, the American
suffragette movement. Yes.
I would have to ask you at some point on mic what you thought of the movie Suffragette, but that's a whole other show. I enjoyed it. I don't know if it was much fact or fiction, but I enjoyed it a lot, and knew, of course, about the horse race that was turned fatal for one of the protesters. More questions. We have two. Vicki first.
Just out of curiosity, are you, with your focus, did you outline it, or were you more of a pantser, like
I was a pantser, a very bad pantser, and that's why it took about almost 5 years to do it. I am not going to be so much of a pantser for my sequel. I did do a lot of times I would take pause and I would start outlining, because if you're working on a series, and again, I almost wish like J.K. Rowling or somebody would write a how-to booklet, like this is how you write a fiction novel series and make it work. Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, unless you know about some books I don't know about.
Actually, there are a lot of people who...
On series,
Orson Scott Card has written articles about that. And whatever one may think of him on a personal level, he is a very good craftsperson, and he writes very well about the craft. But
right.
These were not books. These were articles that are probably on his website, but... Don't go to his website. Do yourself a favor. Don't go to his website. Try to find reprints of his articles on this information.
Yeah, because I've read his How to Write a Science Fiction Novel, which is excellent.
It's one of the best books.
Yeah. But the one thing that I found that I had to constantly revise for myself in writing the first book of the series is basically establishing a canon. And because once you've set up something, you have to stick with it and realize that when you've got a book going on later on, it's like, oh, no, you can't do that because this happened in book one or book two or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I was constantly going back and revising, saying, no, this is not going to happen. And I did tear apart my timeline a few times. Initially, this should have been an 850-page book. But they all tell us, do not write a book over 400 pages, especially if you're a first-time author, if you want to try to find a publisher. So
J.K. Rowling ignored that rule.
No, actually, her first Harry Potter book was like 309 pages. The second one was about 365.
Really?
Then she got into longer books.
And then, she got successful, the books got fatter, and so did the wallet. Yeah.
But I, going forward for my sequel, I'm definitely going to be outlining more, and I'm also concurrently working on a contemporary psychological thriller.
Ooh.
And I am definitely outlining that one, because I started writing chapters, and it's like, okay, this is a great chapter. Where am I going to put it? How am I going to position it so it makes the best impact? And that's, you know, where you get into the story structure thing. And that's why I'm going to start outlining a little bit more from now on.
Okay. So. This gentleman over here. You, yes.
Do you have a major Hollywood talent in mind to play the role of the character, or are you envisioning possibly an unknown?
Well,
who would you cast? We have to repeat it for the radio.
Yes, absolutely.
Who would you cast as the time traveler?
Yes. Believe it or not, there is an Irish actor who I've seen in some independent film clips, and he's doing a lot of theater in London right now, and his name is Robert Sheehan. Mm-hmm. And I think he's perfect. He's the right age. He's about 25, and he's got the look. And I've seen his acting ability, and of course, I'm not worried about him doing an accent if he's doing London theater and he's originally from Ireland. So I'm sure he could tweak it a little and get the Scottish accent going, but I think he'd be perfect. And his was the original mock-up that I did for the one sheet when I was going to pitch this in Hollywood, and we could not use his face because I did not have time to contact his agent or his manager, so right. We did not have permission.
It'll be interesting to see how it plays out when just when Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell came out.
Yes.
I did a couple of interviews with Susanna Clarke, and this is like 12 years ago, and we discussed the casting.
Ah.
But, of course, the TV series was not done until, 10 years later.
Yeah.
But we were dealing with people of the time and talking about somebody like Bob Hoskins. So these things change as new actors come along.
True.
But it's a good question because, I mean, I wonder how many people have played not only, forget Sherlock.
Yeah.
That goes into the hundreds.
Yeah.
But there's probably been several dozen who have played Conan Doyle at one time or another.
Probably, yeah. I know with Sherlock, because I did a lecture at FIT on Conan Doyle, and the character of Sherlock Holmes won the Guinness World Book of World Records for a human fictional actor played by more people. And this includes theater, film, and television. But there were more people who played Sherlock Holmes than anybody. The only person who superseded him was Dracula. But Dracula is not quite human. But there were more actors that played the character of Dracula. But otherwise, Sherlock Holmes won the Guinness Book of World Records.
Even from the beginning with William Gillette and then moving on for years and years. But we have come to a pinnacle with TJ.
Yes.
And I think that might be a perfect... are there any more questions? Otherwise, I think we can move on to the next chapter.
Absolutely.
Let us do that then. And you're going to read your epilogue.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to question TJ.
Well, I will actually, just by standing behind, how did you develop? I noticed that you're holding back on the accent. And by the way, may I say thank you, because we don't have subtitles here. And the Scottish accent, if you've ever heard...
Well, that depends. If it's a Glaswegian accent, you're not really what I'm saying. But since he's from Edinburgh and he had spent a lot of time in London, it's a little more Sassenach-ish for all of you. So it's less, because an Edinburgh accent is much clearer. It's softer. And he was a very soft-spoken man. And he had a much deeper voice than my normal voice. So it's pushing the air.
There's a little bit of sound footage of him available.
Yes, it's
very
just before his death.
You go to YouTube. Is that a question for TJ?
Yes.
I noticed that your book pretty much takes your literature icon and sends him into his own Sherlock Holmes and Mystery Adventure. But my question is, what is the biggest theme that you want your readers to take out of your book? There has to be some sort of twist to it that you want your readers to definitely take out. And the first thing they say about it when they explain to someone else who might be interested.
Okay, you're going to have to repeat that question.
Yes, of course. She asked about what is really the biggest underlying theme of the book. And one of the large underlying themes of the book is the theme of reincarnation. And I kind of mix reincarnation with time travel. And the way that I handle it in the book is when people go back in time, there's a karmic lesson to be learned. And they can't always choose their destinations, as if there's maybe unseen forces that are above and beyond our control that take us to where we are supposed to go in order to learn a lesson. And in every, there will be a subplot in all the books of the Time Traveler Professor series where a lesson is to be learned.
Ooh, okay.
And in this particular one, I don't know if I should give the spoiler.
Don't.
No, don't. Okay.
They can buy the book.
Yes, they could buy the book.
Well, give us a little of the reveal, and a little taste.
Right. Well, John ends up giving his best friend, as well as Arthur, a facsimile of the time machine that he has invented. So Arthur has managed to experiment a little bit on his own, and they end up doing dual experiments with each other. So they end up going back in the past, and they think they're going one place, and they wind up in another, and they find out that they knew each other back then. And unfortunately, not under the best of circumstances.
Excellent. That, I think that's enough of a taste.
So it's almost be careful what you wish for. Too much knowledge is not always the best thing.
Okay, so now let us get to the epilogue of the reading itself, and I'll be back after that.
Okay, this particular chapter is called The Wrong Destination. And this is a little while after John and John Patrick Scott, our protagonist, and Arthur Conan Doyle have been doing some of their psychical experiments. But Arthur also has some, he's an active member of the Society of Psychical Research. And there's a lot of very, very famous politicians, scientists that are members of this thing that all want to prove the existence of various psychic phenomena, as well as the existence of life after death. So basically the setting is that Arthur is at one of these meetings, and he is having drinks or tea with two of the other members of the Society of Psychical Research. So I'll be playing two male parts, as well as John Patrick Scott's part. And this is how the chapter begins. One of the dangers of being a neophyte of the arcane is that occult manuals were deliberately encrypted to ward off meddlers and mischief makers. We're probably that way for very wise reasons. Those of us with special permission to enter such unknown realms were still wandering around wearing blindfolds most of the time. Often I subjected myself to many blunders in order to perfect difficult techniques. This applied to my expeditions in time travel, and it certainly affected my excursions in astral projection as well. In my case, I would often project automatically and subconsciously while sleeping, which was the hardest time to exert control over my actions. One evening, the Society for Psychical Research concluded a séance at the private residence of Sir Oliver Lodge, a prominent physicist and mathematician. Afterwards, Arthur commenced a lively discussion with Lodge and Frederick William Henry Myers, a classical philosopher and scholar who was one of the Society's founding members. Goodbyes were exchanged as the other attending parties either parted for the evening or split off into separate conversations throughout the house. "So what do you think?" Lodge asks Arthur as the three of them enter the library. One of Lodge's house servants entered with a tray of refreshments, set it down, and left the three men in privacy. "I'm glad our medium was able to dispense with any props or gimmicks," Myers said.
"I agree. Humans might be dependent on technology, such as the telegraph, to communicate with each other, for the most part, unless they've developed powers of telepathy. But since our departed friends in the spirit world no longer have the need for such physical things, they should be as easy to contact using non-physical techniques."
Myers interrupted. "When one uses a Ouija board, I'm convinced that the planchettes are moved by humans and not by spirits. Back in the 1850s, scientists such as Michael Faraday and William Benjamin Carpenter conducted experiments saying that even table tipping was created as a result of an ideometer effect, or automatic human muscular movements without conscious volition. But before we move on, tea, anyone?" Arthur barely took a sip of his beverage before he opened up the topic of conversation straight away on theories and principles about apparitions and hauntings.
Gentlemen, earlier this evening we were discussing dreams and their importance in psychic investigation. I'd like to present another authentic dream case. On February 8, 1840, Edmund Norway, the chief officer of the ship called the Orient, had a dream between the hours of 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. in which he saw his brother Neville, a Cornish gentleman, murdered by two men. In that dream, Neville appeared on horseback. One of the assailants caught the horse's bridle and then shot him twice. The two thugs proceeded to beat him and dragged him to the side of the road, where they left him to die. As soon as Edmund woke up from this terrible nightmare, he promptly recorded it in writing and shared the event with the other officers of the ship. One thing that made him take special note in the dream, the road in Cornwall appeared as it always he remembered it, but the house, which should have been on the right, appeared on the left side of the road, which he found unusual. As time passed, he discovered that this murder actually occurred, and the assassins, two brothers named Lightfoot, were executed a few months later. In their final confession, they confirmed that they killed Neville during the time of the brothers' dream.
I do remember that, Myers said while relighting his pipe. It was written up in one of the prominent occult review magazines.
These are actual facts, although they cannot be explained. During sleep, there is a part of us which can detach itself and visit distant scenes, though the demarcation between waking and sleeping is so complete that it's rare that the memory of the night's experience is carried through. Some people call it etheric body. Others call it subconscious self. I could give you additional accounts, but...
All three were distracted as books started falling off the library shelves behind them.
John, what are you doing?
Unaware of my own actions, I ignored him and continued tossing more books about. Lodge rose to his feet and pointed at the commotion. Gentlemen, don't you find it strange? Books have been tumbling to the floor. Myers looked perplexed. Arthur tried to play dumb. Arthur interrupted, eager to divert their attention.
It's psychic residue left over from our session. I'm sure whatever activity is going on, it'll fade in a few minutes.
Believe it or not, what was really happening was that I had been astrally sleepwalking and inadvertently producing telekinetic activity. I had no control over what these paranormal movements would start or stop.
In the dream of his brother, Norway used a technique which I call traveling clairvoyance. Similar events can also occur in the delirium of high fever. Thus, it can be conceived that the consciousness of the sleeping man drawn by love and sympathy was able to link with the spirit of his brother and witness his murder, and still be able to carry that experience through to his normalcy. A normal memory.
Later that evening, during our midnight tete-a-tete, John, Arthur was upset.
What possessed you to spy on us?
Pardon me, I was exhausted from all my studies and fell asleep earlier in the evening. It was only in the past hour that I woke up because of our little arrangement.
You interfered with our discussion and started throwing books off the shelves like a fractious child. Don't you find that behavior inappropriate?
I was completely baffled as to what he was insinuating. I don't believe I did anything like that. And if I did, I wasn't aware of it. Why would I deliberately sabotage your meeting? Did any others see me?
I don't suspect they saw you, but they definitely witnessed the results.
Well, if that's the case, I apologize. And we'll try to find a way to be more cognizant of my actions when I'm sleeping. But spying, Arthur, I wouldn't dream of it.
Well,
So, obviously, people are going to continue to mingle. We hope that everybody present is going to buy two copies of Silent Meridian, because it's so good, you have to give one to a friend and tell them that they have to give one as well. In the meantime, we would like to thank Teal James Glenn. Elizabeth Throwens and the Mysterious Bookshop, which will probably be broadcast in about a week. If you go to my Facebook page, I'm Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. You can pick up a flyer at the front of the store. I'll let you know through Facebook or wherever when this will actually be broadcast. And in the meantime, thank you all for coming, and thank you for writing that book.
Thank you.
And once again, that was Elizabeth Crowens, C-R-O-W-E-N-S, at the Mysterious Bookshop, along with Teal James Glenn as Arthur Conan Doyle, and we hope you enjoyed it. Tune in again next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. for a liver edition of Hour of the Wolf. And in the meantime, please, everybody, be good to each other. Take good care. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers, coming your way right after this program.
FM. Jim Foyne will be back next week, same place, same time, right here at your favorite radio station, 99 Sinker WBAI. Great show, Jim. Tune to Radio Station WBAI 99.5 FM New York. WBAI.org.
It's election time again at WBAI. The nominating period for vacant seats on the local station board is open until June 30th. In order to be eligible to run for a seat or to cast a vote in the upcoming election, you must be a member who has paid at least $25 membership between July 1st, 2015 and June 30th, 2016, or have volunteered 3 hours during the same period, or have received a hardship waiver. Your local station needs your support. You can meet the candidates and sign a nominating petition at Brooklyn Commons, located at 388 Atlantic Avenue, on June 17th, 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., or on June 22nd, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. For more information, visit elections.pacifica.org or call 646-535-4059.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead, and you're listening to non-commercial radio in New York. WBAI is a place to turn to.
Peace. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping genocide singing. Oh my God. Hear my mother got a sleeping suicide singing. Oh my God.
When I leave, you can hear my dad. Last words on my lips. I am a revolutionary, and you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the red, white, and blue who spit on you.
Hey, it's 3 o'clock, punto enseguida, por favor, para ti todos los días, en Imperialistico de America. In other words, it's 3 o'clock right here at 99.5 FM, WBAI, WBAI.org, burn, baby, burn.
Too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria, trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torturing the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They said that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
Mexico.
talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, A, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah. My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Not for war.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle the Star Spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Land the free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. You flag America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
To whom does the house
the fate of the world is won. Stop the dirty tricks, let the people overcome. The future's looking strange, without some real change. Everyone's working for the us. Is it my JD imagination? Boy, everyone's working for the us. Or am I asking too many questions? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Everyone's working for the us. All across the land, they implement their plan. Everyone's working for the us. From sea to sea, they manifest their destiny. Everyone's working for the house.
Seen his face before. Nobody was really sure he was from the House of Love. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away.
Somebody spoke and I went into a dream.